Alors bonsoir, merci d'être venu pour cette conférence du professeur Bob Becking que je vais présenter très très brièvement parce qu'il ne faut pas prendre trop de temps de sa leçon. D'ailleurs, le professeur Becking comprend parfaitement le français. Si vous avez des questions ensuite, vous pouvez tout à fait les poser en français.
Lentement.
Lentement, voilà. Donc, le professeur Becking a fait des études de théologie et des sciences des religions aux Pays-Bas. Il est devenu ensuite, après avoir été pasteur quelques années dans l'église réformée des Pays-Bas, il est devenu d'abord professeur assistant et ensuite professeur ordinaire à l'université de Utrecht. Et maintenant, il a un titre magnifique qui est « Research Professor ». Quand vous êtes « Research Professor », vous ne vous enseignez plus, c'est ça, hein? Donc, vous faites que de la recherche et puis vous êtes même dans l'hiérarchie encore supérieure au professeur titulaire. Donc, un poste tout à fait magnifique. Et qu'il fait la recherche, ça, il n'y a pas besoin de le prouver. Vous pouvez regarder toutes les publications que je ne vais pas détailler. Je voudrais seulement mentionner quelques œuvres majeures. Donc, M. Becking a écrit une dizaine de monographies, des articles, à pas les nommer. Il en a beaucoup, beaucoup. Je voudrais mentionner un des premiers livres et un des derniers. Ah, non, j'ai oublié le premier. Le premier que je voulais amener, puis j'étais un peu pressé, c'est sur la chute de Samarie, donc sur ce qui a suivi les événements de 722 avant notre ère, où en effet, Bob Becking, un des premiers, a en effet confronté les documents assyriens aux documents bibliques et a fait une étude qui reste jusqu'à aujourd'hui une étude de référence pour tous ceux qui s'intéressent à l'histoire, aux origines des fameux Samaritains. Alors, puisque j'ai pris aussi ce livre-là, je vais aussi le présenter. Ensuite, il s'est beaucoup intéressé aussi au livre des rois, ça va intéresser notre ami André Lemaire, dont cet ouvrage « From David to Gedalia », où il y a toute une série d'études sur le livre des rois, en tant que livre historique, mais aussi en tant que livre idéologique, « Story and History ». Et le dernier ouvrage qui vient de sortir, c'est un ouvrage sur les livres d'Esra et Néhémie et la construction de l'identité du judaïsme ancien. Donc un livre qui vient de sortir l'année dernière, je crois.
Il y a déjà deux ans.
Deux ans. Voilà, je fais circuler ces livres et je voudrais juste, pour aussi introduire un tout petit peu le sujet d'aujourd'hui, vous signalez que Bob Becking vient d'écrire un article qui s'appelle « Global Warming and the Babylonian Exile », donc réchauffement planétaire et l'exil babylonien, donc un rapprochement qui peut paraître un peu inattendu, étonnant, mais vous allez voir, il y a des choses à trouver. Donc je suis très heureux que Bob a accepté de venir d'Amsterdam, je pense vers Amsterdam ou Utrecht. Utrecht via Amsterdam à non. Paris. Non? Non?
Via Rotterdam.
Via Rotterdam. Bon. Mes connaissances des Pays-Bas, je sais pas, sont un peu limites. Voilà, donc je lui laisse la parole. Il va nous présenter son exposé et puis on aura quelques moments pour lui poser des questions. Merci.
Merci beaucoup, Thomas, pour m'inviter au Collège de France. C'est un grand honneur pour moi. I will switch to English now, if you don't mind, because I can order a coffee at the shop. I can ask when the metro leaves, but I don't think that's enough to have a talk in this very famous center of intellectual activity. History is man-made or woman-made. This implies that everything that took place in the past is the result of human actions. These actions, however, are not free. They are constrained. One of the constraints to human action is climate. It's a clear boundary of what people can do or cannot do. And I would like to discuss this afternoon the climate of ancient Israel in a broader framework, because I think there are four important concepts: landscape, technology, climate, and demography, and they all are interrelated. When something happens in one of the four, something else will happen in two or three of the others. And I will restrict myself to the period of the so-called Iron Age in Israel or Palestine, which is roughly from 1200 before the Common Era until Alexander the Great marching into the ancient Near East. Climate in the Holocene is the period from the last Iron Age, last Ice Age until present, has not been constant, but due to change. After a general global warming around 10,000 before the Common Era, the average temperature of today was reached. Warmer and colder, drier and wetter periods, however, have left their traces. The traces are now being made visible thanks to the GISP2 program, the Greenland Ice Sheet program in Greenland, where they go into the layers of ice that have been accumulated over the centuries to reconstruct the weather in earlier times. My question for today is, how are these oscillations in the climate pattern that we can detect of influence to human behavior and the flow of history in ancient Israel in that period? And I will start with my first example, being King David. King David is an intriguing figure and has inspired artisans through the ages to create impressive works of art. Almost universally known are the marble sculptures by Michelangelo and the German novel by Stefan Heim. David plays a role in Shakespearean drama, and a recent novel by Joseph Heller is composed as the memories of David from his dying days. Through the ages, David is modeled and remodeled into a wide variety of figures. All these images of David can be seen as appropriations of the biblical character, or at least some features of him, into the cultural and societal context of the various artists. What strikes me is the inherent and continuous ambiguity in the character of David as depicted in art. Next to the tenderness of David's heterosexual love for instance, Bathsheba, but there were other women in his life, as depicted by Rembrandt and Chagall, stands the beautiful book-length poem rewriting the story of David and Jonathan in homoerotic terms by Stephen Schechter. Leonard Cohen's song, Hallelujah, is full of references to King David. In this song, the paradoxical and ever-changing relationship between God and the human being is painted in lyrical words. David's ambiguity comes to the fore in the line, "Your faith was strong, but you needed proof. You may enter if you like." It was a head of a person showing and evaporating. I don't know whether that happens quite often in your city. So I shall not be, thank you, that's quite a relief. In the Hebrew Bible, King David is already portrayed as an intriguing and paradoxical figure. The depiction of this king is colorful and multidimensional. In the narratives of Samuel and 1 Kings, the reader meets a character, so to speak, of flesh and blood. The author presents the image of a king who is just, but nevertheless acts immorally on occasion, who is steered by wisdom, but nevertheless falls a prey to his passion and temper. In short, this king has lived through all ambivalence of human life and suffered from its ambiguity. Within the narrative world of the Hebrew Bible, David is said to have established the so-called united monarchy of Israel and Judah, and to have brought this empire-like state to its first period of wealth and power. All these artistic and biblical images are not to be seen as descriptions of what happened, but as ideology, as images. re-representing the reality. The interesting question would be, I think, both for the historian and the theologian, whether this ideology on David could be linked to history, or, in other words, to what degree is the biblical picture of David to be seen as an ancient appropriation? What do we really know about David? And that's a tricky question. A question that is connected with what is history and what is historiography. I could talk about that for hours, and if you don't mind, I will do it only for a few seconds. One should be careful in reconstructing or constructing the past. Of course, it should be argued that the traditional and or biblical image of David is incorrect, since it cannot be found in the sources. This argument, however, is fallible for several reasons that are connected to three important historiographic concepts: the character of the sources, the notion of truth, and the idea of narrativism. I will not dwell too much on these three points. Suffice it for the moment to state that we only have at our disposal traces of the past, footprints in the snow of history on the basis of which we can reenact the past. The historian hopes to work with a correspondence theory of truth, but is already happy when the coherent theory of truth can be applied. A good historian tries to avoid the pragmatic theory of truth. Historians write narratives, and they rewrite narratives. What I'm doing today is, in a way, telling you a story, hoping that the story is evidence-related enough to be convincing to you all. Recently, or not so recently, four so-called Lives of David appeared, written by Steve McKenzie, Brooke Halpern, John Van Zieters, and Joel Baden. They each portray a different David. I will not enter into much details of their presentations here, they will come along slightly. Although I appreciate much in the work of these great scholars, in the light of the methodological remarks made above, their proposals are in need of refurbishment. Phrased otherwise, I would follow, to some degree, the recipe of two famous historians, the biblical scholar Manfred Weipert and the postmodern historian Hayden White. Following their signals implies that I will make a clear distinction between research and writing. The research leads to the rough material of unconnected propositions on the past. It is the historian who, in an autonomous narrative, offers a presentation, a representation of that past. That, by definition, is not factual and must compete with other autonomous narratives. I will first and foremost concentrate on the existing evidence, the footprints in the snow, because not every narratio on David would be adequate. Not every appropriation of this king, be it in words or pictorial, can be assessed as successful. When it comes to the application of my ideas on historiography to the history of David, five dimensions need to be discussed and searched for pieces of evidence and possible propositions on the past, in this order. Firstly, landscape. Secondly, climate. Thirdly, archaeology. Fourthly, epigraphy. And finally, Hebrew Bible. I'll start with the landscape. Israel, it would be of great interest to discuss the landscape of ancient Israel in full detail, going from Dan to Beersheba and back. For the purpose of today, it suffices to note that ancient Israel, or Palestine, was a hilly area that contained various and differing agricultural zones. The mountainous core of Judah was blessed with soil that was as such fertile. This core area, as well as the surrounding semi-arid zones, however, was in constant need of rainwater, including a technology to avoid the running off of the rainwater. In other words, the area had great agricultural potential, but needed an intelligent cultivator. Climate. So I'm now coming to the core of my talk. I would like to make at first a short remark on the difference between the concepts climate and weather. Weather is what happens over a short time, and climate is the behavior of the atmosphere over a longer period. Weather is the specific condition of the atmosphere at a particular place and time. Sunny spells today are typical autumn weather for Paris. Climate is seen as the average of the weather over a longer period. Climate change refers to change just over time at the global or regional level. You cannot say, last year it was raining on December the 3rd in Paris, and now the sun shines, we are sort of going through a climate change. No, there's a weather change, and that's something else. Hopefully it will rain again, not rain again next year on this day. Climate is a feature of histoire conjoncturelle and weather of histoire événementielle. Aaron Horovitz was one of the first historians to pay attention to the effect of changes in climate to the course of history. It should be noted that his research is quite one-dimensional, since it is restricted to only one set of data. The climate of the past can now better be understood thanks to the GISP2 program in Greenland. In the ice masses of Greenland, traces can be found in the yearly snowfall and its variation over time. The results of this research are astonishing. They open a window into the past and its climate. It turns out that during the Holocene, or post-glacial period, the global climate went through a series of changes. Quite soon, or relatively soon, the general temperature reached about the level we now have, but afterwards it was not all the same. There were waves and undulations, sometimes at a greater magnitude than we experience today. The lowering of the average temperature in subtropical climate, here you see another, this is what I was looking for. This is from another graph, and you can see that not long after the year 1000, before the Common Era, there was quite a strong global cooling. The lowering of the average temperature in a subtropical climate implies an increase in rainfall. This is not only theoretical true, but it can be deduced from the fact that the seawater level at the Dead Sea was rising in that period, because more and more water was coming down. By implication, an increase of rainwater, especially in combination with improved technology, the construction of terraces, leads to the presence of more water for agriculture and to a better harvest. And this all will lead to better conditions for living on the land. Do we have evidence for all that? This is a graph on rainwater. And now I'm going to archaeology. I would like to open this section by a remark made by John van Zieters, who wrote, "We now know with a high degree of confidence that the social historical context in the court history of David simply cannot be supported by the archaeological context for the 10th century and must belong to a much later age." I do agree with John van Zieters that the stories as we now have them are of a much later age. But that does not imply that there never had been a David or that some parts of the stories are older than he thinks. This view too is correct insofar as it regards archaeological findings that can indubitably be connected with all sorts of details from the life of David. And we don't have them. We don't have one-to-one connections. We don't have, let's say, the skeleton of Uriah the Hittite. Or we don't have the soap of Queen Bathsheba and things like that. Nevertheless, there exists archaeological evidence from the period in which David supposedly lived, the transit from Iron Age I to Iron Age II. Problematical, however, is the fact that almost all of these remains have in the past been interpreted from a specific paradigm, that of the so-called United Monarchy. This view that accepted the existence of a united monarchy under David and Solomon, who supposedly reigned as kings over a vast territory supported by state bureaucracy, is no longer valid. This implies that we no longer can talk about Solomon's stables at Megiddo or David's building activities throughout the land. Recently, however, two new claims concerning archaeological findings that could be connected or linked to the time of David has been made. The first is found in a large stone structure in Jerusalem that has been interpreted by Elad Mazar as the palace of David. She is criticized quite heavily for that by all kinds of archaeologists, saying that she is looking as one construction, several constructions that should be dated to different periods. So I don't think that the claim that we have now found the palace of David is correct. Recently, excavations at Girbet Keyefa have brought to light the remains of a short-term occupation of the site in the 10th century before the Common Era. The site has been identified with biblical Sha'arayim. The site is overlooking the Elah Valley where, according to the biblical account, David fought Goliath. Sha'arayim was a key location for the kingdom of Judah along the main road from Philistia and the coastal plain to the eastern hill country. The excavations at Girbet Keyefa are important for two reasons. Firstly, the pottery types found at this site differ from the pottery excavated at the Philistine city of Gat, located 7 miles west from the same period. This might indicate distinct ethnic identities. And secondly, at Girbet Keyefa, an ostracon of 5 or 6 lines of ancient Hebrew script was discovered. And I will come back to that later. Here you see the scholars from that field can produce such marvelous graphs, saying that it is most probable that the area was inhabited, the city was inhabited around the year 1000 and abundant before the year 900. I will now move to this is the inscription to which I will come back later. To demographic developments in Iron Age 2a. In fact, the excavation at Girbet Keyefa that there is a new settlement, although it lasted for no longer than a century, reinforces an observation made by Paula McNutt on demographic developments during Iron Age 2a in Judah. In her view, based on a variety of excavations, an increase of population in the area of Judah in Iron Age 2a can be detected. The climate change mentioned above, cooling down, could have been instrumental in this development. This view concurs with two things, a recent found and a risen insight. And I now will move to apiculture. I don't know how many people in the audience have bees in their garden. excavations at Tel Rehov have brought to light the remains of an Iron Age apiary, a large number of beehives from the 10th to the early 9th century before the Common Era were found. The remains make the impression of an almost industrial production of honey. The number of beehives gives the impression that honey was produced not only for the local market, but also, or even especially, for reasons of export to nearby markets. Mazar and Panitz Cohen assume that such a large-scale production of honey needed a central authority to carry out broad-scale economic and administrative policies, such as would have been required to set up and maintain this apiary. In other words, they see the apiary at Tel Rehov as evidence for the early emergence of a state with administrative abilities in Judah and or Israel. They assume that it is only by the directives of a central power that a more complex system of production and distribution could emerge. This is a biased view. It is a view, I will not say this directly connected to a Politburo or whatever system, but I think that mankind doesn't need a central administration to start economic activities. And I will give you an example from the early Bronze Age, where nomadic groups were able to organize factory-like copper melting activities in the area of Jordan. The metal forging and the distribution of commodities took place without the support of a nearby city-state. In my view, economies can blossom without the impulse from a central organization. And it is only a complex and blossoming economy that could ask for a central organization in order to defend the grown interests. I will skip this because it's more of an appetizer that they were eating bears in the city where these apiaries were found. And I will go now. There were inscriptions next to that, which most probably were connected to the delivery of commodities elsewhere. And I will come to terrace cultivation. All agriculture is depending on three features: a fertile soil, enough water, and the presence of a cultivator. In the Levant, the construction of terraces on hill slopes has very ancient, even prehistoric roots. During the early Bronze Age, the technology was implemented on a larger scale. This technology helped to arrest the runoff water and to make it useful for agricultural purposes. A second advantage has been that more horizontal surfaces for agricultural use came into existence, which made the work for the cultivator much easier. Next to that, a system of terraces is very helpful in avoiding erosion. Within the history of terracing, there are only few technological improvements. The application of iron for agricultural tools and the introduction on the terraces of Judah in the Iron Age most certainly would have led to a greater control over the various phases of the agricultural cycle. Next to that, the number of agricultural terraces increased during Iron Age too, as can be shown from all sorts of examples. It goes without saying that a better form of arresting runoff rainwater could lead to a larger outturn in harvest and hence to more food, which could have been the material basis for the demographic development mentioned above. we have seen the beehives. We will now go to not a commodity, fish. During excavations at the rock cut pool near the spring in Jerusalem, 7,500 fish bones from Iron Age 2A have been found. About one third belong to a particular family of species. No less than 2,300 bones belong to maritime fish. From the available evidence, it can be deduced that some sort of fish market existed in the era near one of the city gates. The presence of the remains of maritime fish implies at least some sort of trade network that could function without the presence of a bureaucratic state. The consumption of fish and its proteins would have helped the physical condition of the inhabitants of Iron Age II Jerusalem. I construe it to be one of the factors for the demographic development. And I now come to epigraphy, which is very tricky because one of the world's most famous epigraphers is in the audience, and maybe I'm saying things that he doesn't like. This is the quite famous House of David inscription, or the Tal Dan inscription. And I assume that André Lemaire has informed you on another occasion on this inscription. The evidence from the Tal Dan inscription makes clear that about a century and a half after he assumedly lived, David was seen as an eponymous ancestor of the royal lineage of Judah, even from an outsider perspective. I'll skip all sorts of details because I don't like them, but it's not central to our discussion today. David must have lived and ruled over what is now known as the Southern Kingdom. The question of the historicity of the narratives in Samuel and Kings and their mutual and the manifold propositional elements and claims cannot be decided on the evidence of the Tal Dan inscription. A name is not a story. I come to a second mention of David in the so-called Mesha inscription. I think most of you have seen the inscription in the Louvre Museum. Based on first-hand observations of this well-known inscription, André Lemaire proposed to read in line 31 as follows. Maybe he changed his mind, and then we will hear it, but... And the house of David dwelt in Horonein, a place in the Transjordan area. Although I might have my doubts on this interpretation, I do not dare to phrase them in an audience as this at such a close distance of the Musée du Louvre. Lemaire's view makes the historicity of David plausible, although the text does not give any information on the life of David. And the third piece is the Sheshonq relief made by an Egyptian pharaoh, Kitchen, not the English word, but a person, proposed to read in the famous relief of Pharaoh Sheshonq carved at the Temple of Amun in Thebes, the highlands, the heights of David. His proposal, however, is quite speculative, and not being well versed in Egyptian, I leave it aside. On the basis of the epigraphic evidence, a clear and sound conclusion can be drawn. The references open the lane for accepting David as an historical figure, but no information on his deeds and doings is given in them. The assumption can even be phrased in the language of a correspondent theory of truth. The historicity of David as a person can be seen as true since it corresponds to the evidence from reality. This is a restricted truth since it only holds for the figure of David, but not for the various stories on him. I will now go quickly to a whole set of minor inscriptions from the time of David in which he is not mentioned, but I would like to show you that I've done my housework in reading and researching all these inscriptions. These are connected to the apiary I mentioned before. There are on jars. There's a third one. This is a very interesting thing. From whom to whom. So the construction from X to Y could be connected to a delivery of commodities. This is a newly found, I think it's found, was found earlier this year, and the scholars are still discussing on what to read and what it means. So this is very important, the Tel Zayit abecedary. Tel Zayit, probably ancient Libna, is a place in a borderland area, borderland between Judah and Palestine, in the 10th century, where a abecedary was found. An abecedary is not a text to read, but it's a text that contains all the letters of the alphabet. As in my, when I was young, half a century ago, the school board contained the alphabet A, B, Z, D. Now this is an abecedary. Abecedaries can be construed as part of scribal education, with or without the existence of a school building. Many of them have been found, and it is interesting to see that in the 10th century before the Common Era, we already have, so about the time of David, we already have an abecedary. Now I come to the Kirbet Keyefa inscription. There is much discussion on it, and I have a view on it that it is a school text. It's an exercise by a person trying to grasp the art of writing ancient Hebrew, and the contents of the text are some sort of traditional wisdom on the social dimensions of faith and life. You shall not do it, but serve. Judge the slave and the widow. Judge the orphan and the stranger. Plead for the infant. Plead for the poor and the widow. Take revenge by the hands of the king. Protect the poor and the servant. Support the stranger. I give it for better. But most important is to see that this text can be construed as a writing exercise. It becomes clear from the irregular shapes of the characters. There is a sign called Aleph in Hebrew, which is about the same as our A. And if you look at it, you see at least three different versions, one up, one down, and one to the right. So he was not, he had not yet decided which Aleph would be his Aleph. There is a metathesis, so a blurring of letters in line 4, Yedaf instead of Beyat. And as you see, there is the second line is going up to the right. I remember in my youth when I was writing postcards from holiday, and when you had too less space, you would go up the last sentence and write everything down. Then you are not a very well-trained scribe. So this, I think, is a school text. In his evaluation of the epigraphic evidence from the 10th century before the Common Era, Seth Sanders notes that the inscriptions that I discussed above challenge both the somewhat idealized reconstruction of a a world full of bureaucracy, Solomonic state, and the somewhat preconceived dismissal of complex culture in the 10th century before the era. So he is saying what we can conclude from these inscriptions is both attacking a maximalist view that there was a big state, an important state with a big set of bureaucrats, but also the very minimalistic state view that says there was hardly anything, maybe two or three farmers. He said there must have been more than that, because there was literary activity, and this activity was related to what I see as an upcoming agriculture that more and more supplied not only the local market, but a super local market. Most inscriptions can be connected to agriculture at its trade, some to luxury items and none to the functions of a central state. I therefore conclude that the epigraphic evidence from the 10th century can be related to a period of demographic growth and economic change. Population growth, upcoming trade, and starting literacy were signs of the time. They were not orchestrated by a central state. They can be seen as element of a histoire conjoncturelle. These developments were in need of a stronger administration to defend eventually the economic interests that came out of them. Therefore, the kingdom of David better could be construed as neither world famous and great nor non-existent, but as something like an ethnic entity that would become a nation, a patrimonial society in growing. A fiscal bulla from Bethlehem. I assume that in France you also pay taxes. Maybe not as much as we do, but certainly more than they do in Switzerland. Even before its official publication, the 7th century bulla found while sifting the soil removed from an archaeological excavation in Jerusalem has stirred the minds of scholars and the general public. The bulla can be classified as a fiscal bulla used to seal tax shipments remitted to the taxation system of the Kingdom of Judah in the late 8th and 7th centuries. The inscription is said to contain the first extra biblical reference to the topographic name Bethlehem in the 7th year, Bethlehem to the king. Although I doubt the reading of the second line, I would argue that even in the case Bethlehem is to be read here, the bulla only indicates the existence of the village or small town in the 7th century. The bulla is inconclusive on for the existence of David, or, as a claim made in America, for the historicity of the nativity stories in the Gospels. We now come going back a little bit. The Dead Sea level curve that we have seen 15 slides before of the late Holocene shows dramatic level rises and falls that are associated with average annual precipitation, which is more than the annual rainfall today in the southern Levant. Such episodes of multi-year increase and decrease in annual precipitation are considered, in modern water resource terms, as excessively wet and extremely prolonged drought, respectively. This implies, this strange complex sentence implies that we see through the Dead Sea water level that there have been periods of rain and wetness, but also periods of drought. We cannot give dates to them and say, well, from 843 to 840 there was drought, and from 798 to 795 there was much rain. But it gives a little bit of a backdrop of all sorts of biblical stories in which, for instance, drought plays a very important role. So now I will move. I like this picture. I don't know why, but I liked it. All the data I just discussed, the change in the climate, the increased technology for the terrace cultivation, the improvement of the diet using fish and honey and other things, all lead to the conclusion that there were improved conditions for larger produce and greater harvest, which would stand at as a first step to a population growth. So you see that the combination of landscape, weather, climate, demography, and technology led in this era to a population growth. What does that mean for the Hebrew Bible? Well, I'm not here to defend or attack the Hebrew Bible, but when we are talking about David, various proposals have been made. Biblical scholars are never, and it is maybe it's interesting of our field, we never agree all over the world on all aspects. There's always something that we don't agree about. And one of the things we don't agree about is when were the stories on David written and composed. The traditional view is by Rost, and he says there were eyewitnesses report in the court histories, but this is connected to the so-called United Monarchy hypothesis. Walter Dietrich said these stories about David were royal proof texts from the time of Hezekiah, by which people who want to become scribes could learn how to behave as a loyal servant, even towards an ambiguous king. Steve McKenzie said we should read against the grain. My question to Steve then is, if you read against the grain, how do you know what the grain is? Bruce Halpern said that all the layers are recognizable but pro-David propaganda. John van Zieters, in a very interesting book, said that, well, there's nothing historical about David, that everything we have is late post-exilic, the David saga, and it is a text written against the Ezra way of ethnic cleansing. But what they all have in common, except for us, is that texts are later views of the past. And then the question is, what do we know about David? And then I would say we know nothing in the sense as, well, I can say I know it's almost 6 o'clock. Yes? We cannot talk, we don't have such kind of knowledge about King David. What I would present is my reenactment, is my way of what I think that, given the earlier part of my talk on what happened on the climate level, on the societal level, etc., what David can I imagine on that stage? And then I'm using the concept of reenactment that was introduced by the historian Collingwood, which in a way was a dilemma, a way out, a dilemma between realism and skepticism. Skepticism says the past is a foreign land, we cannot enter it. Realism says, but of course the past has been there, so we can easily go into it. Yes, in your dreams. So a reenactment is a mental reconstruction or a mental construction of the past based on as many evidence as possible. And it's always open for debate. So maybe your questions will lead me to rewrite my paper. What do we know, or what do I think we know about David? David is a young man from an upper middle class family who, in the absence of economic means, he had 7 older brothers, had to go his own way, who wandered about as some sort of a warlord, offering his services to anyone who would pay, be it King Saul or the Philistines, who could be compared with the Gapiru from the Amarna correspondence. The Gapiru was some sort of bands that were trying to enter the land that was inhabited and to turn off everything that was there. And who was doing so, offering his war capacities, to build a solid power base that he later expanded through marriages. Where the word marriage is, well, not the romantic concept as we think about, but sometimes he almost raped the girls to become his wife. Using Hebron as a springboard, he was able to gain control over parts of Judah and Israel. Once king, he reigned over a local and a rather restricted area. He did not really found a nation. He did not really organize a bureaucracy. Economic blossoming and not nation building led to the first forms of administration and writing. In short, David was a very human being who took advantage of the changes in society evoked by an increase of population and was more of a macho than the gallant image of the little shepherd boy I was confronted with in Sunday school times. by images like this. I don't know, Thomas, if we have a break or shall I continue? You continue. Then I take a sip of water. And I will go to my other example. And those of you who have read my article in this volume edited by John Ahn already know what I'm going to say. And for those who have read it, maybe it's a nice reminder. The Babylonian exile, so I have about 10 minutes, so I will do it quite quickly. The Babylonian exile has often been approached from a Judean perspective using all sorts of available written and archaeological sources. And in order to overcome this prejudice, it would be more than worthwhile to either look at the exile from a broader, let's say, Babylonian perspective, or to consider the period from an overarching point of view. And that's where, yes, in my school, when your phone is not off, you should... You know the system? That's why my wife and I are phoning for 10 years now for free, because all of these... these are just a few images that tell you that all sorts of cosmic influences, the rotation of the sun, the distance of the sun to the earth, the rotation of the axis of the earth, sunspots, etc., etc., are of influence on the weather. And this is something else. I've told you the difference between weather and climate. This is not important. This is the Holocene temperature variations with the main line in thick black and local other things there, which leads to a picture like this, and then to a more comprehensible picture. You see the medieval climate optimum. So that's the page where the great cathedrals were born and followed by the little ice age around 1600 when the city of Amsterdam had the canals frozen where all these famous Dutch paintings were made with people skating on ice. And nowadays we are happy when we have one day of ice in the winter. But if you go back in time to the peak around 500, you come to an interesting period. You see that after the conquest of Jerusalem, the conquest of Jerusalem falls in a period of global warming that goes up much quicker, much deeper than we experience today. The so-called global warming we are experiencing today is not such a big deal in comparison to the other ones. When Cyrus has conquered Babylon, then the climate changed. I don't know if there is any one-to-one connection to it, but after Cyrus, after the installation of the Persian Empire, there was a relatively rapid global cooling. And that implies that we'll skip this, that in the 6th and 5th century, so after the Persians became the masters of the world, the climate was, the weather was cooling down, which implies less water in the sea, more water on the lands, more water in the rivers, more water for irrigation, for agriculture. And that together with improvements in the irrigation canals, implied that in Babylonia or the Mesopotamia, the life was increasingly getting better and there was more and more so-called biomass, so more and more products, more and more food to eat, so the population could grow. And now I will go to relatively recent found made in cuneiform studies, set of archives, some 400, 500 cuneiform tablets are found, not yet published. We hope that they will come out soon all. And these tablets were, according to the colophon, written at a place called Al-Shanasher, so that's a place of the city of the eagle, and Al-Yahuda, the city of Yehud. They were in the, this is Dutch, in the surroundings of Persepa, and they were newly reclaimed agricultural areas. So the Babylonians had, unlike the Assyrians, scattered deportations. The Babylonians kept ethnic groups together. Not only the Judeans, but all sorts of other groups we know about were living in close to each other in some sort of local semi-independent communities where they could raise to some wealth and where they should have to till the fields, royal crown fields, for instance, to produce food for the increasing population of the big cities of Babylonia. And in view of all this, it is very interesting to note that these people, no, I should tell it otherwise, the cuneiform tablets are dated. And you can see a whole of them, the dating doesn't stop in the end of the Babylonian Empire. When the Persians came, it continued. And what continued? The presence of Jewish, so to speak, names. Names that have Yahu or Yahweh as their theophorical element in it. So Judeans or Jews stayed in Babylonia even after the moment they were allowed to return to Yehud, to the Promised Land. Maybe the conditions there were better than they thought. And then something else, because technology is always very important. When you improve the agricultural technology, you will improve the amount of the harvest, the greatness of the harvest. And in the second century before the Common Era, the cedar plow in Babylonia was improved. Don't ask me for details about that, but you can read it in this book by Potts, that they could go deeper into the soil, which means that there was much more to raise from the land. It's always the question about exile and return. Is it a forced migration? Or is it a free migration? I think that the exhalation of Judeans into Babylonia was a form of forced migration. But when they remained there, even after they were allowed to return, I think exile turned into a diaspora. I hope that I have shown you with these ample words that the changes in climate are of great importance to understand ancient history. And I also hope that I have made clear to you that climate change is not always the only factor that is of importance. It's always a combination of technology, climate, politics, organization that improves the quality of life or that decreases the quality of life. And I could have given you all other examples, but I think my point has been made. I thank you for your patience.